some members that are excused actually arrive. If you have a copy of the agenda in front of you, I'd like to point out that Senate Bill 978 is going to be moved to the end of the agenda. I apologize for that, but you will notice that it is scheduled for a work session, and so therefore we want to have all the members present. If you happen to come today for Senate Bill 408, it is going to be moved forward to a future date, so we will not be hearing testimony or having a work session today on Senate Bill 408. And having said that, the remaining portion of the agenda we're going to go forward with, and right now I'd like to open a hearing on Senate Bill 899. And Cletus, you'd be happy to bring us up to date.
Mr. Chair and Committee, SB 899A abolishes Multnomah County Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission, allows county with population of 500,000 or more to establish Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission if the county obtains approval of county governing body and taxing district within the county. There are no conflicts with this bill. There's an A-7 amendment. Deletes the current Section 5 and replaces it to allow any county may establish a Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission.
Thank you. Members, questions of the administrator? If not, I have two individuals signed up. Dennis, and I apologize, Mulvihill, and Dave Boyer. If you both gentlemen would come up. Dennis, since I called you first, if you'd enter your name into the record.
Dennis Mulvihill, Government Affairs Officer for Washington County. Good afternoon. Washington County is here in support of this bill with the Dash 7 amendments, which you have before you. A little history here. I provided testimony that I'm going to just hit the high points on it. If you want to get into it deep, there's three pages worth there. So,
thank you.
1919, the Oregon legislature required that Multnomah County have a Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission, which is in simple form a governor-appointed commission that has oversight authority for all the taxing jurisdictions in Multnomah County. Because of the Oregon's Constitution, they couldn't specifically say that Multnomah County had to have a commission like this, so they put a trigger mechanism, which is a population. So any county over 500,000 has to have a Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. They also provided at that time that any, or someplace along the way, it's since it was so long ago, some of the stuff is buried deep in the archives. But they also allowed that any county could vote to create a Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission. In simplest form, Washington County's amendments gets rid of the population trigger, which Washington County and Clackamas County is right behind us, is going to have 500,000, and it would require us to have one of these commissions. What we want to do with the Dash 7s is it allows Multnomah County to retain their commission, and it allows citizens in Washington County or any other county to vote to create a commission. Let me just say a couple other things. I think a lot has happened since in the last 86 years, since this commission was imposed upon Multnomah County. Local government budget law was created, and that is arguably one of the most citizen-oriented budget laws among the states. Electronic and printed media, the web, the internet, we all have a lot more at our disposal to communicate with citizens. And Oregon's Constitution was changed to prohibit unfunded mandates, which we would argue that a population trigger that requires us to have a TFCC and to spend up to $280,000 violates the spirit, if not the fact, of that Constitution on unfunded mandates. Let me end by saying that all the mayors in Washington County, the Washington County Board of Commissioners, and Clackamas County Board of Commissioners join us in support of 899A with the -7 amendments.
Thank you, members of the committee. You have questions of Mr. Mulville? Mr. Boyer.
Good afternoon, Representative Boquist and members of the committee. I'm, for the record, I'm Dave Boyer. I'm Chief Financial Officer for Multnomah County. And Multnomah County supports Senate Bill 899 in its present form. I want to make sure that that's understood in its present form. We believe the cost of the tax supervising far outweighs the benefits to the taxpayers of Multnomah County. Similar to other counties, Multnomah County has an elected auditor. We have internal audit requirements, requires public votes on all tax measures, has the county financial records audited by external auditors, and adheres to local government budget law, and we submit our budgets to the Department of Revenue as every other jurisdiction. And Multnomah County goes through a lot of due diligence in taking our budgets and a lot of other measures to our public. Just to give you some examples, Multnomah County's charter requires a citizen involvement committee, and the citizen involvement committee has oversight over our budget advisory committee, which is made up of citizens, and they meet and review our department budgets. They make presentations and review our dedicated funds to make sure that they are being used in the appropriate manner as specified in our financial records. They also make their presentations during the budget process when we're going through the approval and the adoption. They make presentations to our Board of County Commissioners. And in addition, we hold many other public forums, not only during the budget process, but throughout the year. As an example, this last fiscal year, we went through and we had citizen focus groups. We had citizen forums all through the fall talking about our budget. We had citizen groups during the month of January and February where we combined with the Citizen Involvement Committee and the City Club of Portland to review our budget. So, and as Dennis said, we also have all of our budget, all of our programs out on the web so anybody can view them. As Dennis said, the ORS 294 for the tax supervising does require us to provide funding for $280,000. And to give you an idea, $280,000 would buy 6 public health nurses who provide public basic health care for the county's most vulnerable. $280,000 could increase our prosecution of drug and gang-related property crimes with 5 deputy district attorneys. $280,000 could also pay for 5 juvenile counselors who provide a variety of services to at-risk youth. So we think since 1919, when this was put in, a lot of things have changed. The county adopted a charter in 1967, so we have a home rule charter, which, like I said, involves a citizen involvement committee, and we think we have a lot of public involvement and scrutiny as we develop our budget. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Members of the committee, questions? Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'm going to direct this question to Mr. Mulvihill. We just heard from Mr. Boyer and why Multnomah County doesn't need the commission. Is there anything different between Multnomah County and Washington County's circumstances that would make a continuation of this commission appropriate in Multnomah County and not appropriate in Washington County?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, the only thing I can think of would be that they've had theirs for a long time, and we've never had one, and if I think they need the support of all of the taxing jurisdictions in the county and to have it changed. And what we saw on the other side was that there was some ambivalence with other taxing jurisdictions. It isn't just the county that has is under the jurisdiction of this TSCC. It's all the taxing jurisdictions. And what we found was that when we put it out there, the various taxing jurisdictions in Multnomah County were ambivalent about whether or not they wanted to get rid of it or not. Now, let me put something an edge on that, though, and that is that it's easy for those taxing jurisdictions to say be ambivalent because they're not the ones paying $280,000. That probably changes their, they would change it if they had to pay for it. So I hope that gets at your question.
I do want to follow up to clarify. So I think what you're saying is that it's not just the county, but it's other taxing entities located within Multnomah County that are subject to the jurisdiction of this commission, but that the entire cost of the operation of the commission is paid by the county. The other taxing authorities may not feel as strongly, since whatever is being, if they perceive any value in what's being done, it's a net plus to them because they're not paying any cost for it. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I think that's what I was trying to convey.
Okay. Follow on the question. This is actually for Mr. Boyer. I want to put that original question to you, Mr. Boyer. Is there any difference functionally in terms of protecting the public and in the nature of the work being done in the two counties that would make the commission appropriate in Multnomah County and not appropriate in Washington County?
Chair Boquist, Representative McPherson, in my opinion, there is no difference, and the only difference is the population size. And I want to go back, since I've been with the county for 25 years, and the population, if I recall right, was at 300,000 at one time, and every time it got closer to Washington and Clackamas and Lane County, the population amounts were increased. So it's, in my view, it's a population number only. Otherwise, there is no, I don't believe, any other differences in our operations from other counties, except maybe the size.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions, Representative Barker?
No.
We thank you for your testimony, and we stay tuned for the future events on this particular bill. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 899. And I'm close the public hearing. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 955. And if our good administrator will give us an update. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 955 is one which applies to require condominium and planned unit or planned community board of directors to include under their annual reserve study a 30-year plan which would allow for the maintenance, repair, and replacement of common elements of the association property, and it requires that the plan be appropriate for the size and complexity of the common elements and property associated with this type of development.
Questions of the administrator before we go on? If not, we have two individuals signed up, John Carroll and Brian DeMarco. If you both want to come up, please. And John, if you'll state your name, I'll let you lead off.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is John Carroll. I'm here in support of the Senate Bill 955. I am a developer operating in Portland. Have been involved in the business for the last 10 to 15 years. The industry, the condominium business, the amount of product has experienced a huge growth in the last 5 to 10 years, and as a result, we are experiencing some things in the growth industry that you might encounter: questions of workmanship, question of about how to deal with defects. And that is central, I know, to the AGC, to the AIA, and certainly to my comrades in the development business. So the issue isn't that we don't recognize that there are those issues to deal with. In fact, in our organization, we will not do business with a contractor or an architect that does not have a quality control program within their design effort and within their construction effort and a turnover protocol to ensure that the building is built pursuant to the plans. That's all great if, at the time you turn it over, you have a plan to maintain the building for the next 10, 15 years. In my own home today, I'm replacing a roof, painting, recaulking the windows, and that doesn't stop because you're just because you're living in a condominium or in a high-rise building. Those efforts have to go are ongoing and must be performed. The reserve study, which was enacted a number of years ago, was a very important piece because it told the homeowners associations you've got to look down the road 30 years and be prepared to replace these elements. What was missing is a very specific plan to ensure that those elements actually live their full designed life. And what this bill does is a very important piece. It does not threaten. It provides direction and a game plan for people to manage their asset. And when you have 50 to 200 people operating in a single building, there needs to be a management plan because the committee is very difficult to work with in those environments. And I can tell you this has been a very important piece. In future projects, we are turning every building over with a maintenance plan pursuant to this. If this doesn't pass, we're going to turn over a maintenance manual and include it in our declarations anyway, just because we think that's a heartfelt approach to dealing with people that are going to have to manage a huge asset down the road. Appreciate your support, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Any questions, Mr. Carroll? Thank you, Mr. DeMarco.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Brian DeMarco. I'm manager for land development and policy coordination for the Oregon Real Estate Agency. In my position, I approve the creation of condominiums in the state. And as such, I have a front row seat to the tension between developers, purchasers, homeowners, associations, and others, particularly with respect to such issues as construction defect litigation and so on. This bill goes a long way to ameliorating those differences and providing a benchmark for everybody, whether it be a purchaser or the developer, to know where things stand. And as a result, this agency strongly supports the engrossed version of Senate Bill 955. I'll be free to answer any questions you may have. We've worked closely with the developer and the representatives and intend to continue to do so to make sure that these issues and other issues are addressed in the coming sessions. Thank you.
Thank you, members. If you have any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Mr. DeMarco, what would the consequence be of the Homeowners Association not actually doing maintenance that conforms with what's in the reserve study and maintenance plan?
Representative, the answer to your question is a legal question. While I'm an attorney, I'm not in the position to give you that legal advice.
Okay. Mr. Carroll, do you have a review on that?
Well, there is, at the time every unit is purchased, there is a disclosure statement that must be filled out by the seller. Again, I am not an attorney, and I will defer to Brian, but it looks like there may be an opportunity to use those mechanisms that are already in place to provide that information to prospective buyers.
If I may, please. The agency is in a position to protect the rights of the consumer, and that is the viewpoint we take when we're looking at any legislation, particularly that legislation imposed by developers and so on. And there's no reason to believe that this legislation would harm the Oregon consumer. In fact, it would seem to me to benefit the consumer because they have a working plan on which to rely on. And too often I get calls in my position saying, I didn't know we were supposed to do that, and now we're suffering as a consequence. And I think this resolves a lot of the I don't knows.
Yeah, this may be a comment, if I couldn't, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think this is a good bill, and I think the idea that we carefully communicate to people who buy units and condominium projects that what it is that they have to do to keep the facility in good condition is a good idea. It does seem to be likely that the consequence of having done that is that if they don't do what was in the plan, that then any damages that are particularly a result of not conforming to the plan, probably they couldn't bring a claim then against the developer down the road, which seems fair to me. I just want to develop that idea.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 955. Stay tuned. And I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 984. If the administrator would be kind enough to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 984 would require the Department of Consumer and Business Services to conduct a review of the assigned risk plan and of the subject employers that are covered by the plan to provide a report to the legislature by August 1st, 2006. The measure also outlines what the review is to determine. DCBS would also be required to adopt rules for consistent application of the workers' compensation rates, the rating plans, and the rating systems. The measure also requires State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation, SAFE, to file a plan with DCBS describing the actions they will take to assist the employers covered under the assigned risk plan to obtain coverage in the voluntary market. Members of the committee, this does have a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Budget.
Questions, Administrator? Seeing none, I'm going to ask that individuals, because there's a large list of people who would like to testify on this, and since I recognize many of the names, if you would limit your testimony to 3 minutes or so we can just have the germane points. And having said that, the two first individuals I'll ask to come up is Sean Miller and John DiLorenzo. Mr. Miller, you may lead off.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent Liberty Northwest in support of Senate Bill 984. The bill comes to you from the Senate, where it passed the Senate General Government Committee with a unanimous vote and the Senate floor 27-1. It does it has two subject areas in the bill, one dealing with the assigned risk pool, and the other dealing with fairness in establishing and assigning risks. And while I do, Mr. Chairman, you have my written testimony, I will only focus on the second part of the bill, Section 5 of the bill, dealing with the fairness in establishing rates, and we'll let John talk about the assigned risk pool. This section assures Oregon employers that the process used to establish and assign rate tiers for workers' compensation insurance are done objectively and fairly. While the current system strives for objectivity in setting rates, it does allow for a level of subjectivity that may, in some cases, present the possibility of unfairly discriminatory rates for some employers. SB 984 directs DCBS to adopt rules to ensure that rates for Oregon employers are set using objective criteria and do not result in unfair discrimination. This process is then protected by requiring that any employer with reasonable knowledge of the subject matter can verify that they are receiving a rate based solely on their risk characteristics and not any subjective factors. The requirements of Section 5 apply to all insurers, including SAFE, Liberty Northwest, and all the admitted carriers. And at this time, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks on Section 5, and I think I'll turn it over to John to talk about the assigned risk pool.
Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner of the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of Oregonians for Sound Economic Policy in support of Senate Bill 984. As you may know, my client waged a five-year-long battle to obtain records from SAFE Corporation successfully, and as a result of that investigation have developed quite an interest in the assigned risk pool. And for the benefit of those of you who may be following along with my testimony, and in deference to the chair's admonition to keep my testimony short, I'm going to start at the bottom of page one. In 1979, the legislature amended Oregon's workers' compensation law to require establishment of an assigned risk plan. And that plan has been in continuous operation since January 1980. Oregon's assigned risk plan, which is also sometimes referred to as the residual market or the assigned risk pool, provides coverage for employers who cannot obtain coverage from the voluntary market, in other words, from other insurers, including Safe Corporation. Section 1 of Senate Bill 984 addresses the assigned risk pool. It is predicated on the view that SAFE's mission and its accountability for that mission should be well articulated and defined. This is because SAFE receives significant advantages by being exempt from federal income tax and being exempt from a host of other provisions which provide SAFE Corporation major advantages in the marketplace. SAFE has these advantages along with those that derive from its status as a state agency, yet it has no specifically defined corresponding public purpose, in our view, commensurate with that special status. The mission, which is defined by ORS 656.752, includes making insurance available to as many employers as inexpensively as may be consistent with the overall integrity of the Industrial Accident Fund and sound principles of insurance. One would assume, therefore, that small businesses that find themselves relegated into the assigned risk pool must have had adverse safety records or other experience which, after application of these sound principles, would disqualify them from being one of the employers for whom SAFE is directed to provide workers' compensation insurance. However, that does not appear to be the case always. Oregon has an extremely high number of employers cast in the assigned risk pool. The chart on page 3 of my testimony illustrates the problem. Among the few states that have similar systems, Arizona only has 0.5% of its total market in the assigned risk pool. Idaho has 1.7% of its total market in its assigned risk pool, yet Oregon has 16.7% of its market in the assigned risk pool. Now, during his testimony before the Senate Committee on General Government on March 3 of this year, Mr. Davey of Safe Corporation briefed the committee about a randomly selected interview of 77 assigned risk accounts, which he had conducted. Mr. Davey reported that the leading reasons for an account having been cast into the assigned risk pool were as follows. Poor credit, 29%. Never applied to SAFE, 17%. Cheaper to be in the pool, 16%. Excessive losses, only 13%. Get that, excessive losses, only 13%. Well, we found that quite disconcerting. Mr. Chairman and members, for most persons generally familiar with the role of Safe Corporation, they assume that companies find their way into the assigned risk pool because of their poor safety records. If Mr. Davey's survey is in the least bit accurate, it appears that poor safety risks only account for 13% of the small businesses who are paying higher rates in the assigned risk pool. The 17% who never applied to SAFE may not have done so on advice of their brokers, who may know that SAFE would not accept these applicants anyway. Of course, if one is in the assigned risk pool, one must pay workers' compensation premiums in advance. If workers' compensation premiums in the assigned risk pool must be paid in advance, why should a small business's poor credit relegate it to having to pay even higher workers' comp rates? The advance premium should assuage any concerns which an insurer might have concerning the applicant's poor credit. Yet according to SAFE survey, poor credit accounted for 29% of the population in the assigned risk pool. Of course, there may be explanations as to why SAFE does not include within its public mission of insurance many of these businesses. On the other hand, the study could well reveal that SAFE should be covering these businesses. For that reason, Senate Bill 984 requires a review of by the department to determine why are these people in the pool, whether their initial placement in the pool and coverage in the pool are in accordance with reasonable workers' compensation practices, whether insurers servicing the pool are aggressively assisting them in getting out of the pool, and finally, the reasons for the pricing structures in the pool. Mr. Chairman, with that, I will conclude my remarks, and I hope the little jingle that went off wasn't my time limit. So thank you again very much. We support this bill. We feel a study is in order, given the data that SAFE has previously presented to the Senate committee, and I hope you will feel the same. We're available for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Counsel, and yes, you did go over your time. Questions of either of these gentlemen? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, we'll ask Chris Davey and Brenda Rockland to join us. Mr. Davey, if you'd like to lead off. Oh, Brenda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brenda Rockland and Chris Davey representing Safe Corporation. Safe Corporation's position on Senate Bill 984 is that this bill is unnecessary. As I think you will hear shortly from the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, DCBS already has the authority to conduct most, if not all, of the activities that are set forth in Senate Bill 984. Secondly, until the DCBS study is completed, we won't have a complete picture of why employers are in the assigned risk pool. There's no evidence that Safe Corporation has failed to offer insurance to most of the companies in the assigned risk pool. And for that reason, Section 3, which is directed only at Safe Corporation and not to any of the other, not to the other insurance company that services assigned risk accounts, is unnecessary. In any event, in terms of Section 3 of the bill, this committee, as does any committee involving the legislature, has the authority to always ask Safe Corporation to come before it and explain what actions it's taking with respect to employers in the assigned risk pool, and we will be happy to do that. And so for those reasons, we don't think this bill is necessary.
I have no further comments unless you have any questions.
Are you supporting members of the committee? Questions?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rockland, what about the statistic that Mr. DiLorenzo had in his testimony about the percentage of employers who are in the assigned risk pool in Oregon as compared with Arizona and Idaho? Are those fair comparison states? I understand they were selected because they also have state agency, but not mandatory coverage to the state agency. It is a pretty striking difference in percentages. And is there what do you know about that discrepancy, and what analysis would be done if we don't pursue this bill to address it?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think Mr. Davey's going to address that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, we haven't actually taken a look at Arizona and Idaho to understand.
Would you please state your name for the record?
I'm sorry, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. We haven't looked at Arizona and Idaho to see why there might be a discrepancy in that statistic. The number that Mr. DiLorenzo included in his testimony of suggesting that there is 16.7% of the total market that is in the assigned risk pool, that is actually probably based on the number of employers rather than the premium volume. And the way that these statistics are kept nationally is by premium volume. And we have statistics. I actually have a sheet that I can leave with the committee showing how that premium volume in Oregon has compared with this state with the national picture. That number has actually been going down. It was 9.4% in Oregon by premium in 2003. The estimate for 2004 is that it has gone down to 7.1%, whereas nationally in 2003 the percent in the assigned risk pool was 12% and is predicted to go up to 13% in 2004. So Oregon is actually moving in the opposite direction of the nation and moving in a better direction.
Follow up, Representative?
Yeah, I do. I'm trying to understand the difference. I mean, the comparison before was a comparison to two other states that have the same configuration that Oregon has, which is having a state agency and but not making it the insurer of last resort. And the comparison you were just describing, Mr. Davey, was to a national figure on a assigned risk pool that is not just those states. It's a much higher percentage than these two states are here. So what that suggests to me is that there's something about the way Arizona and Idaho are handling their situation that's quite a bit different from the national pattern in assigned risk, which I'm gathering that those other states that are not part of the averaging then must be ones where the state agency is the insurer of last resort. Am I understanding those right?
Oh, well, Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, I would, again, not having done an analysis of what goes on in Arizona and Idaho, the fact that there are a certain number of employers in the assigned risk pool implies that they are not the insurers of last, that the state fund is not the insurer of last resort in Arizona and Idaho. This study that I understand DCBS is likely to do, whether this bill passes or not, is going to give us more information about why companies are in the assigned risk pool. Some of the testimony that I gave and was referenced previously, testimony that was given in the Senate, is that there's a lot of reasons why people go to the assigned risk pool in Oregon. There is no requirement that any insurance, that any employer apply to Safe Corporation for coverage, and a large number that we found in our share of the assigned risk pool, 17% in fact, had never applied to Safe Corporation. And also, because of the peculiar pricing structure of the assigned risk pool in Oregon, it's actually cheaper for some employers to be in the assigned risk pool, paradoxically, than it is to be with an insurer in the voluntary market. So these are things that we hope DCBS is going to look at during the next couple of years. We have also made a strong commitment to do a better job. We think we're doing a good job right now of making insurance available, but we've made a commitment to really focusing on that in the next 2 years and seeing what we can do to make that even work even better in Oregon.
You have a follow-up, I was saying?
Just one more question, and that is, if DCBS is going to be doing what's described in this bill anyway, is there a harm in our saying so in statute?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I guess if they're going to do it anyway, the question is, why do you need to have it in statute if they're committed to actually going forward with that study, which I believe they are.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions of this panel? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up, and I apologize if I screwed anything up, Corey Scheisinger from DCBS.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, very good job on the name, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which includes regulation of insurance and also the workers' compensation system. And as you've heard, the assigned risk pool is the mechanism established by Oregon law to provide workers' compensation insurance to employers who aren't able to obtain it in the voluntary market, and many of those are small employers. And we agree with a number of the comments that have been made about the desirability of taking a good hard look at this pool. We actually took a preliminary look this past interim, and it raised a number of interesting issues about how the assigned risk pool works, whether we can or should be providing better coverage in the voluntary market. There are a number of reasons why small businesses in particular are in the assigned risk pool, some of them beneficial. The law does provide some discounts for new and small businesses that can make the assigned risk pool a favorable place. In addition, there are some situations in which the minimum premium is lower in the assigned risk pool. So we want to take a good look at who is in the pool and why, how long they stay, and whether there are mechanisms that, in fact, can have the voluntary market playing a more vigorous role. So as has been mentioned, it's actually our intention to take that look regardless of whether or not the bill passes. The other issue addressed by the bill is the issue of workers' compensation rates. Under current law, we are required to review and approve rates before they can be used. We review for non-discrimination. We review for actuarial soundness, and we have rules in place now that govern that review. But we certainly have no objection to doing a new rulemaking if there are concerns about consistency of application. We have no objection to being directed to do so by the legislature, but we can also do so upon petition by interested parties. So that is within our current power, and certainly maintaining non-discriminatory rates is something that we're very interested in. So I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, madam. Questions?
I guess I just wanted to. Does it make any difference whether we pass this bill or not in terms of what DCBS does? And
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, no. The only there are two small items that the bill addresses that are not within our current within the department's current powers. One of them has to do with specifically directing SAFE to come forward with a plan, and that is not something that that we can direct under current law, although I think you heard the executive director of SAFE say that the legislature could certainly request SAFE to come forward at any time. The other very small item with respect to the rates is that this bill, and I'm now looking at section 5 sub 2, the bill would allow the department to make what are currently confidential backup information for rate filings, would allow us, although not require us, to by rule make some or all of those filings non-confidential. So that is the one small item which is not currently within our rulemaking power. We don't see that as particularly significant one way or the other. As a general rule, we support openness and transparency in those filings, but we all are also aware that some workers' compensation insurers feel that that information is trade secrets and would not look kindly toward that information being made public.
Is that responsive?
Yeah, that's fine.
Follow up?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Jack Monroe?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today on behalf of the American Insurance Association. I think, as we all know, we have a concentrated insurance market in the state of Oregon with two principal workers' comp insurers. AIA members write something approaching 30% of the market elsewhere in the country, but have a very small share of the market here in Oregon. I'm here really have no interest in the assigned risk provisions in the bill, but do have an interest in Section 5 of the bill. And we view that section as being both anti-competitive and not necessarily being in the best interests of Oregon consumers. If Oregon desires to have a dynamic and diverse market here in the state of Oregon, you need to encourage people not to utilize the same standards and the same template in underwriting and rating various risks that are out there. And we believe that the language that's in Section 5, while it sort of looks innocuous on the surface of it, is one that will force a certain rigidity in the way companies structure their rating plans, and we don't view that as being, as I've said, consistent with either the consumer's best interest or the best interests of insurers that might want to have a higher profile in the state of Oregon and take on additional risks and business here. We also have some concern with the second section of five, which is very tortured, I think, in terms of what it says, but the existing process is one whereby certain bits of information relative to how elements of the rating plan will be used are kept confidential because they are proprietary, and at least in the minds of insurers that ask that they be kept confidential. No insurer necessarily wants to hand over its strategy, if you will, for utilizing its approved rates to a competitor. And you need to understand that a lot of insurers, at least other than the big two here, are here writing specialty business, and they've invested a lot of time and energy in obtaining that expertise, and aren't necessarily interested in handing and sharing that expertise with others who are less expert and less knowledgeable. So we are very concerned about the language that's in Section 5, and if this bill were to go forward, we would hope that it goes forward without that section. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any more questions of Mr. Monroe? Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Monroe, So your view is then that Section 5, and it's I think particularly subsection 1, which says that DCBS shall adopt rules for consistent application of workers' comp rates, rating plans, and rating systems, that's a departure from what the way that workers' compensation insurance is regulated in Oregon now? Is that right?
Well, I think that's right, because what, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, what that is suggesting, and not suggesting, it is saying that the director will adopt rules that, and as I say, it seems innocuous relative to the consistent application of rates, rating plans, et cetera. Now, on its face, that raises, you know, a series of questions about what the hell does it mean. I think you'd have to go back and take a look at the some of the discussion that occurred on the Senate side and some of the earlier versions where there was specificity laid out with regard to what we might be talking about here, and that is requiring specific standards for the placement of business in various rating tiers that might be developed, developing specific criteria for when you can deviate from a filed plan. And you know, in our mind, that that'll probably, I guess, have the effect of requiring people to have you know, specific rating programs that they won't be willing to deviate from. And again we feel that that's just not a good thing. I think we would not, for example, want every financial institution in this state to have the same general loan policy, because the effect of doing that would not necessarily be in the best interests of certain consumers who qualify under one institution's policy but don't under another, or one institution is more willing to take a chance on somebody than another.
That responsive?
So I hope that's responsive.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
No, thank you.
Oh. Thank you, Ms. Monroe.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 984 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1032.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1032 is a bill that deals with schools and the urban growth boundaries. Specifically, the bill will deal with requiring Metro to work with the local school districts in the Portland metropolitan area to plan and do an analysis of future school sites that were currently located outside of the Portland UGB area. And so this would be the analysis that would then include the reason for having Metro to be involved with it would be including the sites for their specific constraints to school suitability for the future development for schools, and we'll also look at other planning activities that Metro may be aware of, such as future lands for industrial or residential uses, and how they would also be compatible with school district needs for future schools. The process that would be developed would also allow for a fairly quick decision to be made on expanding any urban growth boundaries if they're determined to be needed to accommodate the future school needs up in that area. I'd like to point out that there's no revenue or fiscal impact, and also that this bill passed on the Senate side 25-5.
Any questions, the administrator, before we proceed? Seeing none, Gary Conklin and Randy Tucker. And Gary, you'll be first.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for this hearing today. For the record, I'm Gary Conklin, representing the Beaverton School District. The Beaverton School District has added 10,000 students in a little more than a decade. These students, if they were in a separate school district, would represent one of the largest school districts in the state. As it is, they're located in schools that currently are within our district. The Portland metropolitan region has a very unique situation in that UGB decisions are made on a regional basis. In the last periodic review, for example, Metro added a substantial amount of land to its UGB, but principally that land was in the eastern side of the region. School sites, which are included in the analysis of land needs that go into deciding how much land is added, But in fact, they're not factored in on a district-by-district basis as to who needs the school sites in a particular area. Beaverton has run out of school sites inside the urban growth boundary. Just a little history. We have condemned a homestead in the southwest part of our district for an elementary school. We just finished condemning a longtime family-owned nursery for a middle school. We've expanded existing schools. In fact, we're in the process of expanding one elementary school that will have a capacity up to 1,000 students. We've built two-story high schools. And most recent acquisition that we had for a school site cost us $600,000 per acre. We are preparing to ask our patrons one more time, this will be the sixth time in less than 15 years, to approve another bond measure that in all likelihood will call for another high school, another middle school, and at least two elementary schools. We don't have sites for any of them. Senate Bill 1032 calls for a collaborative effort between Metro and school districts such as Beaverton to identify school sites outside the UGB if no sites exist inside the UGB. The idea is to promote good planning and to put schools in areas that ultimately will be urbanized. SB 1032 also directs Metro to develop an accelerated approval process to add school sites to the UGB, but it does not take away Metro's ability to determine whether UGB expansion is warranted or whether a special land need exists for such an expansion. The decision continues to rest with its discretion. Senate Bill 1032 is a compromise that follows a decade of disagreement and vetoes over how to insert school siting into effectively into the land use planning process. For Beaverton, at this point, after that decade of inaction, doing nothing is no longer an option. We have every fall another 1,000 students who show up at our doorsteps that we have to educate. We need places to put them, and we need sites on which to build the schools to house those students. We urge your support for Senate Bill 1032.
Mr. Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area. As Gary just described to you, this has been an issue that has been the focus of some battles over the last several years. Our battles over it stretch back into the last century. I'm pleased to be here today with Gary in support of Senate Bill 1032. It's been a good discussion that we've had this session about how to try to get some resolution around what is a real problem. As Gary described, that this is a serious problem here. Metro does not question it, the difficulty is that there are no really easy solutions out there. I'm here today to express the Metro Council's support for Senate Bill 1032. It requires the Metro Council to develop an expedited process for urban growth boundary amendments that occur in between our regularly scheduled urban growth boundary expansions. That is a process that we're already, I believe, developing in response to some rule changes, changes to Goal 14 that LCDC has recently adopted. And then the other piece of this bill that I think is very important is the line 10 on page 2, at the request of a high growth school district, we shall assist them to identify school sites. And that basically comes down to collaboration on trying to work together about what the direction of future growth is going to be in the region, because as Gary described, the Beaverton School District and other high growth school districts have to come up with money for sites. They only do that every so often. They want to invest those sites in places where they are actually going to be able to build schools, and the work that we do helps us to be able to predict the direction of future growth and be able to work with school districts and making sure that those investments are in the right places and make sense. So I'm pleased to support Senate Bill 1032. My understanding, I don't believe there's any opposition to this bill, and we would urge your passage.
Thank you. Members, questions?
No question, Mr. Chair, but just a comment I would offer up, which is that I think we need to transition a bit in our sort of mindset about what space needs are of a school. I know that my own children went to Cleveland High School in Southeast Portland, which is an inner city urban setting school was in three stories. I caught the reference to some building two stories as though that were a major sort of intensity of development, and I think there's a tradition of schools being multi-story. So I think that, while I certainly support the bill, I think that we ought to be imaginative about building up in our schools just as we are in other kinds of structures in the metropolitan area.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, don't disagree with you. Even building two-story schools required us to get special permits for elevators. The additional cost for us, given the fact that we have special education children that show up in ambulances at schools, are enormous. The schools of today are not the schools of other periods of time. We have a lot of demands on us, and we are trying to use our space as intelligently as possible. Our district has a collaborative agreement with the Tualatin Hills Park and Rec District, so every time we build a school, we build parks and recreational facilities. We try to build them as efficiently as we can. Our just dilemma is, when you look at the largest high schools in the state, you won't be too surprised that they're all in Beaverton.
Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1032 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 321. Do we have an administrator for 321? Okay. Just stand fast a minute.
That would be a no.
That would be a no, yes. Okay.
You want to do 1015?
Yeah. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 321. Okay. And I'm just moving it to the end of the agenda, folks. We don't have an administrator to explain it, so don't go off the deep end. And I'm going to, we're going to come back to it. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1059.
Vice Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1059A comes to you from Governor Kulongoski. This is the bill that would provide that juveniles found guilty except for insanity or found mentally incompetent to stand trial may be committed to a secure intensive treatment facility as opposed to commitment to the Oregon State Hospital. The status of the current law is if a juvenile is found guilty except for insanity or if a juvenile is found unable to aid and assist, the law requires that they be committed to the Oregon State Hospital. And as probably as most of you know, recently the youth ward, Ward 40, I believe it is, at Oregon State Hospital was closed, and that facility can no longer accommodate the placement of children. This measure would create statutory authority for the commitment of such children to a secure intensive treatment facility designated by DHS rather than to the state hospital. It also gives the Psychiatric Security Review Board the statutory authority to order continued commitment of a youth already within its jurisdiction to the same sort of secured inpatient treatment facility. There is a Dash A4 amendment before you that was just received late this afternoon, and that resolves a conflict with Senate Bill 39A. Senate Bill 39A has passed both chambers but has yet to reach the governor's desk. What 39A essentially amends a portion of 39A amends one section of 1059 and thus the need for the conflict. This is going to, again, clarify that the PSRB may commit a youth rather than to the state hospital to a secure inpatient treatment facility designated by DHS.
Questions, Minister? I have one individual signed up, Bill Bauska. I hope I didn't butcher your name. Thank you.
Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Bushka. I'm the team leader of the Children's Treatment System with the Department of Human Services, Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1059A. As explained, 1059A provides a statutory language change which is critical to allow certain persons under the age of 18 to receive treatment and evaluation in a setting other than the Oregon State Hospital. And as spoken, the last unit serving adolescents closed in March. Senate Bill 1059A allows the Department of Human Services to designate a secure intensive community inpatient facility. And that facility opened at the same time the unit closed. The Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services has developed the secure adolescent inpatient program, and it is designed and operated to provide all the mental health treatment and evaluation services while maintaining public safety. The program is designed and it is operated to provide the mental health and treatment services which were previously provided at the Oregon State Hospital. The Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services is very supportive of this bill, and I thank you for the opportunity and be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Representative McPherson, do you have a question?
I do not.
I saw that look. It almost looked as if you did.
No?
If there's no questions, thank you for your testimony. We appreciate that. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1059, and we have the administrator here, and I'm going to reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 321. And for those of you who got a little nervous here, we're just trying to get the administrator here so we can understand what's going on. It doesn't count.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 321 modifies the definition of employment relations in public collective bargaining for the employees who are prohibited from striking to include staffing levels and safety issues that have a potential impact on the job safety and workload for the employees. Members of the committee, attached to your staff member summary, you do have a fiscal impact statement. That statement basically provides additional comments on the potential impact of the bill, but the fiscal impact per se is indeterminate. Please review it at your earliest convenience. And I have no amendments at this time, Mr. Chair.
Questions to the Administrator? That I have an entire sheet in front of me of testimony. I would ask that you limit your testimony to 3 to 5 minutes. Five for the primaries and three for those that are in the supporting roles, so to speak. And with that, the first two individuals I'll call up is Brian DeLaschmalt. See, I apologize. And Pat West. Now, Pat, I can't screw that one up, can I?
Hopefully not.
All right.
I can.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pat West. I'm president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm here today representing the paid professional firefighters in the state of Oregon, which, by the way, we represent somewhere in the 95% to 97% of all the paid firefighters in the state. I'd like to start out. I have a sheet. Sorry. That just kind of has some bullets that deal with Senate Bill 321. First off, I'd like to say that Senate Bill 321 is a common sense bill that simply allows firefighters to discuss issues surrounding safety during negotiations. Many individuals, including employers, have portrayed that the bill is too costly, too speculative, and even unnecessary. However, the fact remains that under the current statutory language, firefighters cannot discuss safety issues during bargaining. This bill would allow for an open and free discussion regarding safety, but also provides many safeguards that protect the employer, particularly as it relates to costs. Here are some of the reasons that you should support Senate Bill 321. First off and foremost, firefighting today remains one of the most dangerous professions in America. Despite many of the safeguards and technical advances that have happened in the fire service in the last 50 years, the fact remains that every 4 days, a firefighter loses his life in this country. Senate Bill 321 does not impose the union's will. Allowing firefighters to discuss safety does not guarantee implementation. It only provides for the conversation to take place. There are those out there that have said that if we're able to talk about safety, that we would not, we would control every issue dealing with the employer's rights. That's not true. We're here to say that the issues of safety are paramount to the firefighters. There's a number of them here in the room. And we need to have the ability, as do 27 other states in this country, to discuss safety at the bargaining table. One of the biggest protections for the employers is the last final best offer. And what this does is it provides a cost control for the employers. It's difficult in 3 to 5 minutes to describe the collective bargaining process, but there are things built into it. If an issue has a de minimis impact, it can be disregarded by the arbiter. If an issue has a huge cost item, that's a separate issue that they have to deal with. If it is, it costs so much that it's prohibitive for the entity to be able to provide that service, then the arbiter must take that into account. But foremost, the arbiter has to also take into account what is in the good and welfare of the public. It's a standalone item. If it is in the good and welfare of the public, better for them to have the safety issue that goes to arbitration dealt with, then it should happen. It's not just safety for the firefighters, but it's also the safety for them to provide the services to the public. Again, I'm trying to hold it down the testimony here. I talked about 27 other states that have specific references to collective bargaining safety in the collective bargaining agreement, excuse me. But more important, in Oregon, we really need to be able to discuss these issues. We need to be able to sit down at the table. We need to be able to talk about how we're going to deal with the different safety issues. I'll use a really good example. 15 years ago in Salem, I was when they first came out with the hoods that we wear, fire-resistant hoods. And so immediately everybody started wearing hoods. This was before they were mandated. And all of a sudden, in Salem, we had firefighters dropping left to right from heat pump station. And this is on reasonably cool days. We finally realized that we had the ones that we had purchased were manufactured in Minnesota and were for sub-freezing, sub-zero weather. And we were wearing them in 70, 80 degree weather. So there's all kinds of issues that you have to talk about safety besides the great big issues that the employers are going to talk about. But most important, we need to be able to have the right number of firefighters to arrive at the scene, to provide the coverage for the citizens, and do it safely. Thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate you keeping your comments short. I think every member here has had multiple visits to their office on this issue already. So, Brian, you're next.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Brian DeLashmet. I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I, too, have submitted some written testimony, and I will focus on one particular paragraph in a minute. But let me give you a little bit more background. Pat tried to do, in a very short, brief period of time, talk about collective bargaining and structure. But let me go back to prior to 1995. Prior to 1995, when an employer and an employee in a strike-barred unit could not come to a resolution on a contract, he would go to an arbiter, and the arbiter had the ability to pick and choose. It was kind of almost like a Chinese menu. They could say, well, I'll take three of these, and I'll take four of those, and I'll split the baby on the rest of the issues. And in those kinds of situations, an individual item like safety, if it had an enormous cost, in fact, could be selected individually if, in fact, it was a very valuable issue, at least in the judgment of the arbiter. But that all changed, and I think the arguments that you're going to hear from the employers, and I know you've heard them, you said you've been visited, just do no longer apply in the context of the new way that the final last best is structured after 1995. And as Pat had indicated, when a bargaining breaks down and goes to arbitration, In a strike court situation, obviously, the employees cannot strike as the ultimate solution to the unrest. So the arbitrator looks at a whole series of criteria. And now they're given instructions by state statute after 1995 on what do you consider. And they also no longer have the ability to pick and choose. They now, it's final last best, so they take the entire package. So the entire last package, the final last best, has to be structured by the employee and the employer to meet a number of criteria. And Pat focused on, I think, probably the most salient point of the negotiating process that really discounts the argument that this is a blank check, somehow this is a runaway hijacking of the budget process by the employees over safety issues. And let me focus on the bottom of the first page. When the arbitrator rules on either the employer or the employee's proposal, they must first make the determination what is in the interest and welfare of the public. Some of them have done a very good job of that. Some of them struggle a little bit with that. But if you go on and look at the other criterias, very first criteria, the second criteria is the reasonable financial ability of the unit of government to meet the costs of the proposed contract given due consideration and weight to the other services provided by and other priorities of the unit of government as determined by the governing body. That, in fact, is the check and balance on the costs right there. So what ends up happening in this process is actually the employees are negotiating against themselves. If they want an issue around safety brought to the table and as a part of the final arbitration, they, in essence, in order to keep the costs contained, may be giving up some health care, maybe giving up some wages, but their package has to be pretty darn close to the package the employer, because the arbitrator is going to look at the financial ability of the jurisdiction to pay for that package, given due consideration to all the other services that that jurisdiction has to provide. So the argument about, well, if we do this for the police or we do this for the fire, all of a sudden you're not going to have anything for roads or for parks or whatever, is just not a reality. With that, I'll end. I do have some examples if anybody has questions about types of issues police officers are talking about as far as safety issues. But this is a very straightforward issue. And it's just a matter of our ability to come to the table and talk about safety and have those issues considered. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions to this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. The next panel will be Ken Armstrong, George Berry, and John Powell. And the three of you quickly figure out who has the five-minute lead and who has the three-minute supporting roles.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Armstrong, and I'm here representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, representing, along with Mr. Powell and Mr. Berry, the larger group of employers that have been working on this issue this session, includes the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, Sheriffs, Chiefs of Police, Special Districts Association, everyone that's an employer that deals with public safety issues. This is a very simple issue to us. This is a prerogative of management to deal with staffing and safety issues. And the statement that was made at the outset of our previous testifiers that you cannot bargain over safety and staffing issues is flat out false and a mischaracterization of this issue. You can, in fact, bargain over those issues if there is a direct and substantial nexus with on-the-job safety. So don't be misled. We believe that, fundamentally, that issue aside, that this is an issue that needs to be dealt with within the context of a broader discussion on public safety collective bargaining. You don't come to the legislature to deal with a no-slice of the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act without taking into consideration the impacts in all the other areas, both to employers and to employees. That's the substance of our arguments, and I'll close and answer any questions.
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Mr. Chairman, members, I might remind the committee that this bill passed by just one vote on the Senate side. As bargaining itself, sometimes these issues are close calls.
I think it is also an unfair characterization of this legislation to say it just allows for a discussion. As has been pointed out, when employees are barred from striking, arbiters make these decisions. Who are these arbiters? They're not necessarily people who are schooled in local government and the broader sense of local government, usually attorneys. So there are significant issues from the management side in providing the whole array of public safety, both within their agency and with other public safety agencies within a county government. The sheriff is a unique office created by, it's actually created in the Constitution, and the sheriff is the lead law enforcement agency in a county. Within that confines, the sheriff has to work with the Board of County Commissioners in helping set the broader agenda for the community and fitting the sheriff's budget within that. In addition to that, under Oregon law currently, a sheriff in Linn County got a budget passed, a levy, operating levy, beyond the normal funding level. But due to compaction within Measure 5, they lost $1 million of that. So even when they saw the need and sought the funds, they were not available to provide additional services. So we would simply agree with what Mr. Armstrong said, and that is if there's going to be changes to the bargaining law, it needs to be in a broader context because there are other areas of the law that would be need to be addressed, we think, at the same time. Thank you.
Mr. Berry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is George Berry. I represent the city of Salem. We're here opposed to this legislation. I would support what my colleagues have said in that the issue has been couched around safety, but the bill addresses staff as well. And staffing is a management prerogative. Management's responsible for determining how many employees it takes to perform certain duties. If we are wrong in our determination that we need more employees, the current law does indeed allow for bargaining on staffing and safety issues that have a direct substantial effect on the on-the-job safety of public employees. That law has been on the books since 1995. I, as a practitioner of collective bargaining and having had the pleasure of bargaining against Mr. West, which is indeed a pleasure, can tell you, sir, that I am not aware of cases where firefighters or police officers have come to us with staffing issues that have an impact on their safety. If this was a concern, it would be a concern to the employers as well, since we're going to pay for making those people whole. I would strongly oppose this bill and support my colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative, questions to this panel?
Yeah.
Representative Barker.
We're talking about the that you have to bargain on safety, but that's it's not a mandatory subject to bargaining, so if the employer doesn't want to talk about it, they don't have to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I would respectfully suggest that the statement was that there is no bargaining on staffing and safety. And, in fact, there is bargaining on safety and staffing if a demonstration can be made that there is a direct and substantial impact.
And direct and substantial, though, has been interpreted to mean imminent and immediate. I mean, this is part of the Senate Bill 750, which passed by one vote, and it was 96 was when that finally the voters finally ruled that. But if you as the employer don't want to talk about that, you don't have to. Is that not correct? If I come to you and say I want to talk about staffing, you just say that we're not going to talk about that. That's off the table.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, if there is a demonstration that there is direct and substantial impact on staffing and safety, we have to bargain it. Other than that, no, we don't have to. However, I would also point out that the language here in Senate Bill 321 opens the door for anything that has the potential for impacting staffing and safety, which couldn't be a broader barn door as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
And I'd also, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, like to point out that of the interest arbitration cases since Senate Bill 750, there's been an equal split of awards between employers and management. So to me, this seems like a pretty fair set of statutes.
Okay, and Mr. Powell, when you talked about the arbitrator being mostly a lawyer, which I would assume that's probably true, but those come off a list where people, each side gets a strike. So you have you should have some objectivity in selecting your arbitrator. And if somebody has a bad record, either side, I was had been involved in arbitrations, and so we'd say, well, we know this guy's history, boom, he's gone, and then the C would take a look and say, well, we know that guy's history, boom. And you finally get to somebody who should be in the middle there somewhere.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I think you just made my case.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Next panel will be John Cock, Randy Davis, and Roy Carter. And could you ring Representative Richardson's office and let him know that we're going to be doing Senate Bill 978 shortly? And gentlemen, I'd ask you to try to limit it to 3 minutes. But you can determine who's going to lead.
Mr. Cox is going to be the lead, sir.
Go ahead, sir.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I passed forward a written prepared statement, and since I have such a limited time, I'll just get right down to it.
You need to state your name for the record.
I'm John Cox.
Thank you.
I work for the Oregon Youth Authority at McLaren. I think the thing that's important for us is that since Senate Bill 750, our population has changed dramatically. And in so doing, with the downsizing and stuff, we have a total of about 864, of which 37% of those belong to the Department of Corrections. This has never been done before. In my own institution, I have 43% of my clientele are Department of Corrections. The safety issues, the security issues, and the training is all combined into one. Our organization says that we're entitled to have 40 hours a year of training. We get 8. The mandated training by the legislature, OSHA, and other agencies, it totals to 103. I cannot get my staff trained to deal with the new clientele that we have on board at this point in time, which I consider to be a real safety and security issue. The other thing is to address the idea that somehow administration and the frontline staff can sit down and negotiate some type of resolution on security or safety issues for us is erroneous. I've been on that committee since its inception in 2004. Every consensus, every recommendation has been overturned by administration where they've turned around and instituted their own plan regardless of what this committee had to say. I don't see, unless we have something to pretty much bring this to a head to get the management and the employee to sit down and to work out a deal, this is not going to happen. They can turn and say, no, we're done now. We've talked all we need to talk. Since 1996, I've had 102 staff assaults. The last one is the permanent disability for an employee done by a young man who has an assault of nature. Most of our workforce is now becoming extremely young, lacks experience. And we have 10% of our workforce is part-time. I find that all these issues become a safety and security issue and a staffing issue, something that needs to be addressed. We have tried it in the conventional way. We have tried everything we can to bring to their attention what our needs are, and yet I have none. I'm very much in support of 321. I think it puts an equal footing, but it also puts an equal responsibility on us to come with a plan which is reasonable, come with one that will satisfy the needs, and come with one that's within the budget. I hope that you will forward this bill onto the House for consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
Hi, my name is Randy Davis. I work at the Oregon State Hospital in the forensics units.
primarily I'm here to support Senate Bill 321. Over the last 10 years, Oregon State Hospital has bulged in size in our forensics population. And if you're unfamiliar with forensics patients, they're committed under the State Hospital under the PSRB, which is the State Psychiatric Security Review Board. Those patients come to us when they've committed crimes and are unable to serve time in the Department of Corrections institutions. And over the last 10 years, we've seen a dramatic change in our population, not only in size, but in the dangerousness of the patients who come to us. The chronic drug problems within the state, including the meth problem that's going on, has bulged our population of people who are traumatically brain injured and very dangerous. So in the last 10 years, the state hospital has not increased its staffing to meet the adequate number. So we've doubled our size in patients, and the number of staff has increased by only 10%. When we bring this up to management within the collective bargaining session, we're told that that's a budgetary problem and that we cannot talk about it in bargaining. And basically, they have said this is our prerogative to not talk about staffing levels as in permissive agreement and bargaining. So we face this every day. We face this current understaffing, which has led to an incredible dramatic increase in our workers' comp claims, over $3 million last year in workers' comp claims at the state hospital from staff-level injuries. The maximum security units alone last year recorded almost 200 staff assaults last year that led to this a part of that $3 million in workers' comp claims. And yet the management at the hospital is making strides in trying to deal with this. We still have the terms of the collective bargaining agreement that does not permit us to talk about safety and staffing levels that get to the point to where they become meaningless letters of agreement that maybe we'll talk to you. So in the last collective bargaining agreement, they agreed to institute an OSHA safety program to train every person at the hospital. That was 2 years ago under a collective bargaining agreement, I received 0 hours of OSHA training. So that was something we pushed for, something they said they would do, and it became a nowhere deal. Basically, what we're asking for is the right to have management sit down with us in a collective bargaining agreement and say, we want you to be safe, and we want to keep it constrained within the budget, and we have to figure out a way to do that. And that's all we were asked for as workers at the state hospital, is to find a way to make sure that everyone is safe, that the patients are taken care of safely, and that the requirements, fiscal requirements of the state are constrained. And if you've seen the state hospital's budget for overtime, just by our employees, just to meet the need that regular employees could meet, that they were hired permanently, it's incredible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Carter.
Hi, I'm Roy Carter. I work for OYA at McLaren. I'm also vice president of OYA Local and SEIU. I would like to speak personally from having sat on the bargaining committee for SEIU on the institutions for the last three bargaining sessions, that no matter what kind of evidence we bring forward to present to support our cases, the bargaining team on the other side has a tendency to ignore them or somehow put it off until we go into arbitration. And at that point, they will tell the arbitrator that this is permissive and we don't want to discuss it any further. I work with Mr. Cox at OYA, and I ask the question of the people who are in charge of this place, what price do you put on the life of a firefighter, a police officer, or anybody that serves the community who works in a non-strikeable position? Your Department of Corrections, OYA, county, sheriffs, what price do we put on their life? What price do we put on having them permanently disabled because they don't want to talk about safety and security and staffing issues? Thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions this panel? Representative.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carter, since you've been on the front line of the bargaining process, I'm curious about how, under current law, the language operates. That is, now there's an opportunity to bring forward safety and staffing levels that have a direct and substantial effect on the job safety. Do you find that you're offering up issues that you'd like to have bargained and they're being carved out of the process by the arbitrator because the arbitrator concludes that standard's not met?
They are being carved out because once we get arbitration, the arbitrator just ferries back and forth between the labor force and the management force and carries back and forth messages. If at any time during the bargaining session the arbitrator is told, no, this is not the arbitration that we're talking about for the state contract. I'm talking about after we've been in negotiations for 180 days, we're entitled to get an arbitrator to come in as a neutral party, carry messages back and forth. He does not make recommendations to the state side. He does not make recommendations to the labor side. As soon as management side decides that it's a permissive subject of bargaining, he carries that message back to us, and it becomes a dead subject of bargaining at that time. It cannot go forward for anything.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Other questions? Representative Barker.
When they talk about the direct and substantial, and now it's interpreted as imminent and immediate, so you go ahead and say, I need 10 more people on my shift and nothing has happened. I don't know, how do you make that imminent and immediate until it's too late? Would be my question to you, or can you? Yeah. Hey, you're probably asking the wrong group.
Chairman, good question, Representative Barker. Currently at the state hospital, and I cannot speak for OIO, but I'm sure they do, they base our level of acuity on the number of patients on each ward and the perceived dangerousness of each patient. So each patient gets reviewed by a risk review board for their level of dangerousness, and based upon their past practices of assaultive behavior or other dangerous behaviors, they're moved from one unit to another based upon their dangerousness, from a minimum security to medium security to maximum security. At any given time, a medium security patient can be as dangerous as a maximum security patient. We're not saying that can happen at any time. The real issue is that as they assess the number of people that we need on a ward, then the level of dangerousness arises and becomes higher. And we can say, look, we have 7 people on this ward who have now done 15 or 20 assaults in the last 3 days. We need more staff. And they will say, no, your minimum number of staffing is 5 for this unit, and we understand that you have people on what they call a precaution level where they're watched at a one-to-one basis. They may assign 1 or 2 of those 7 on that level, which may acquire us 2 more staff. But in the meantime, they've kept our staffing level based upon a unit that is running smoothly with a number of people. The good example is on a unit I work on, and I'm supposed to be on a unit that is supposed to have 30 patients on it. I currently have 42 people on my ward, and my minimum staffing number is 5. On my last day at work, I had 4 different outbreaks of assaultive behaviors from patient to patient that I had to take care of. They told us that we did not need any more staff to contain those people. So in the meantime, I'm handling 4 very assaulted patients. They may have not assaulted me, they're assaulting someone else. But in the meantime, the risk level for everyone working there goes up, because when I don't have people to watch those people, then I'm put in imminent danger. When we explain imminent danger to the management, they say, we are constrained by the number of people that we have. We are constrained by the number of amount of money that they will provide us to put people there. Therefore, the imminent danger is constant and persistent. And when we point that out, they continue to say, no, this is what you'll get.
Thank you. Good. Other questions? Gentlemen, I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate all of you coming here. Representative Dalto has stepped in and would like to address the panel, too.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair. Members of the committee, Billy Dalto, representing Oregon's 21st House District here in Salem, and at the risk of jumping in the middle of an issue that I have friends on both sides on, I couldn't help but I was watching this committee in my office on the television and saw that a couple of my constituents were here testifying just before you a moment ago. And I just wanted to offer this perspective. You know, we had a legislative measure, House Bill 3073, that passed out last week, that was the issue about the psychiatric nurses and other personnel at the Oregon State Hospital and the abuse, the potential to defend themselves in circumstances where they were being attacked by the patients, and how that was exposing them to potential charges of abuse, and wanted to clarify the statute so that people could defend themselves. Well, we dealt a lot with this issue in the Health and Human Services Committee, particularly, you know, if you go out to the state hospital, if you go out to the Oregon Youth Authority at McLaren, for example, where I've been at both locations at the hospital many times, at McLaren once, you know, the environment at McLaren and at the hospital is very difficult. I have a video in my office that shows where a psychiatric worker at the state hospital was attacked, violently attacked by a patient out of nowhere, and really suffered some significant injuries, eyesight, you know, damage, and I don't know if she returned to working, but when you have a situation where you have they're significantly understaffed environments like my constituent Randy Davis, who you just heard from at the state hospital, they put themselves on the line every day to make sure that hospital runs, and I take the issue of safety for them very, very seriously. And with respect to the Oregon Youth Authority, really, which is the reason why I asked to come speak to you, I received an email one day, a very disturbing email from one of my constituents that worked at one of the facilities. He was an officer, I guess, at the Oregon Youth Authority at McLaren facility, and was involved in an altercation with one of the inmates, youth offenders, a violent altercation. The youth attacked him. There was a scuffle. They got onto the ground, and, you know, it's everything that you can imagine. And what was said was, you know, attack this correctional officer while he's on the ground, while he's in the scuffle, you know, it's in the middle of one of these experiences, one of these altercations, you won't get prosecuted for it, so just attack him. And so, you know, these kids know that message, and they're violent offenders, and they exacerbate an assault on an officer there. So I wanted to add that perspective. I don't know if you've toured McLaren, I don't know if you've toured Hillcrest or any of the Oregon Youth Authority facilities, or if you've toured the Oregon State Hospital, but very, very difficult environments to work in. And I appreciate the folks that work there every day, put themselves in those situations to make sure that those facilities are running and that the public safety is taken, is protected. So appreciate their work, and I hope that you take their comments under advisement in this very important matter. So thanks.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. The one thing I'd just like to say, I got a note from Leo Payton, who's in the audience. He's a porter with the Portland Police Association, and he said in the interest of timeliness he won't testify, but they've had problems with getting radios for the officers, and if you want him to, Mr. Chair, he could testify, but he is willing to waive that today.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, and everyone who came forward and testified. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 321. And we're just going to stand at ease for a minute.
We're going to open a public hearing and work session, possible work session, on Senate Bill 978.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 978 comes to you from the Senate Committee on Rules, and what it does, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, expands the District Attorney's authority to limit disclosure of personal identifier information. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under current law, in a criminal matter, if a defendant is not represented by a lawyer, the District Attorney shall is able to limit the disclosure of information about victims and witnesses as it relates to telephone numbers and addresses. There is a similar provision as it relates to defense counsel in what they are limited, what they can give their client in a criminal matter. A trial court in its own can order additional information in that particular case. And what this matter does, if you look in page 2, lines 23 through 25, identifies personal identifiers, means a person's address, telephone number, social security number, date of birth, and the identifying number of a person's depository account at a financial institution. Chair, members of the committee, and what this means is, in addition to telephone numbers and addresses, other information can be redacted and not given to a criminal defendant. We have two witnesses signed up, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, Representative Richardson and Mary Botkin, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a simple bill that has a tremendous need. We in Jackson County have had circumstances where information relating to bank information, social security numbers, credit card numbers have been included in investigation files that have been turned over to defense attorneys and has been turned over to defendants who then, in one instance, have gone to jail, and while in jail have been able to use that data to make life somewhat miserable for those the witnesses or the victims that had provided that information. And so this is a an important fix. It was brought to my attention by Mark Huddleston, who's the district attorney for Jackson County, who said that since he had personal involvement with one such case, that it'd be vitally important if personal identifiers such as address, telephone number, social security number, birth dates, bank and credit card information not be included in the files, although it would be available if a judge were to order it, if it were necessary or pertinent to a specific case, but not just have it be there on a random basis. And so we would ask that this fix be allowed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Bike. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And Representative Richardson and I, you know, we're getting pretty good at this teamwork now.
This did pass unanimously out of the Senate, Mr. Chair, and unanimously across the Senate floor.
Yes, it did. The interesting thing about this is that what we discovered in the Department of Corrections was that inmates have a constitutional right to their criminal file in their cells. I mean, they have the right to that information, and we're not trying to say that they don't have the right, but the problem was is that sort of practice with investigations has not kept up with criminal activity. And so what was happening was officers of the courts and police officers on the streets would utilize date of birth and social security number regularly as a way to identify their witnesses, the victims, and everybody. Well, this all sort of filtered into the criminal file, and nobody was really catching that. And so we didn't have the right. Our officers who work inside the institutions absolutely had no right whatsoever to do anything to those files to clean that information out. And what was happening was that the inmates were actually selling personal identifiers to their friends on the streets to use for identity theft.
Takes private enterprise too far.
Now, let me just be clear. This isn't going to stop crooks from being crooks. It's not going to stop bad guys and bad women from being bad. And it's not going to plug every hole that they're going to discover, because they have a lot of time to serve in some cases and a lot of time to think about ways to get around this. But all we can do is to plug the holes that we find. And we think that with Representative Richardson's amendments and our bill, that together this bill will plug at least a couple of holes. And we don't think it has any opposition. We had a work group put together. Committee staff assisted us with the work group. We worked with the newspapers and the print media, the sheriffs, the DAs, and everybody in the room to make sure that the bill got what we needed to get and didn't step on anybody's toes. And what you have is the finished product in front of you.
Okay, committee members, any questions? Comments?
Motions?
Need a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 978 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker has moved Senate Bill 978 to the floor with a due pass. Any objections or further discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative
Oprah. Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Pierce.
Aye.
Representative Peters.
Aye.
I think that Representative
Bill 978 moves to the floor as we do pass. Representative Richard, would you like to carry?
I'd appreciate that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, we'll have a work session for possible introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that I'm not sure the verbiage right on this one. The LC draft 3717 to a committee bill.
Representative Boquist has moved the LC draft 3717 be adopted as committee bill. Any objections?
Does this mean per diem?
That was a comment.
No objections.
Any objections? Not as adopted. And I believe we're finished for the day.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Adjourned.
All the minutes have received the copy of the agenda.
And I'll also update the contact with the email for our members.